Today is Monday, March 14th, 2011. I'm Martin Lumlin.
I'm Claire Eagle, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It's 5:10 and time for a full hour of independent news. In campus news, we will be bringing you coverage of the upcoming AMS block party and news of the AMS summer plans. We will also be joined in studio by Navi Desange, the treasurer of the UBC Residence Hall Association, who will tell us a bit about the first-year guarantee on housing that will come into place next year.
As well, we'll be talking to Mitch Anderson from the Tai'i.ca about Swing33.ca, a newly launched website designed to identify the key swing ridings in the upcoming Canadian elections, which will allow voters to donate to campaigns in these ridings. Adam Janus will be discussing the UBC Slam Show at Corners Pub.
And all this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Japanese officials intentionally spilled radioactive water into the Pacific today. Yesterday, they said that the Fukushima power plant may well continue to leak for months. Claudia Craig has more.
Regarding this dumping of radioactive material, I am so very, very sorry.
That was the apology before he burst into tears of a senior TEPCO official in Japan. He wiped his eyes as he described the unavoidable dumping of at least 10,000 tons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. The amount of tainted water released is expected to increase as the operation continues for several days. The contaminated water began to flow from the stricken plant around 4 p.m. today. Monday's radioactive dump is at least 100 times normal effluents and is designed as an emergency measure to free up plant storage for ever more contaminated water in a leak that does not appear to be contained. Saturday, Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency said that radioactive iodine has already been found in seawater about 30 miles south of Fukushima No. 1 power plant. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder reversed course today when he announced that despite previous plans to try suspected 9/11 conspirators in civilian courts, they will face military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay after all. Holder had scathing criticism for Congress, who he blamed for unraveling the executive branch's ability to bring Gitmo detainees to trial on U.S. soil. Holder said that in order to prosecute the alleged perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks and deliver justice for victims and their families, that trials must move forward. Despite the reversal, Holder was unflappable in his belief that civilian courts remain the proper venue for these trials.
Let me be clear, and let me be very clear. Our national security demands that we continue to prosecute terrorists in federal courts, and we will do so. Our heritage, our values, and our legacy to future generations also demands that we have full faith and confidence in a court system that has distinguished this nation throughout its history.
The legal process for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and five others will now begin anew. The military dropped its litigation against the men when the White House decided to bring them to trial in the U.S. And the United States Supreme Court today declined to hear three cases brought by still other detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The detainees say they've not been fully granted their right to a meaningful review of their long-term confinement and should be able to take their cases to federal court. For the fourth day running, protests in Afghanistan over the burning of the Quran by a small Florida church threatened to turn violent today. Hundreds wielded sticks and stones. Police replied with live bullets fired into the air. At least 21 people have died during the past few days of demonstrations. In Libya today, opposition forces are moving on Brega, an oil-rich town that's currently under the flag of embattled President Muammar Gaddafi. Italy joined France and Qatar today in recognizing the opposition's rebel council, the Transitional National Council, as the rightful government. A Gaddafi senior aide was in Turkey today for talks following a similar visit to Italy yesterday, where a rebel spokesperson said that they would not accept a plan to replace the senior Gaddafi with two of his sons. Also yesterday, a Turkish ship ferrying 250 people wounded in Misrata docked in Benghazi. Many of those aboard were women and children. In Egypt today, health officials updated the death toll from the recent revolution there, saying 840 people died and almost 6,500 were wounded. The numbers reflect those who died or were treated in medical facilities. General strikes shuttered businesses and schools across Bangladesh today. Protesters rallied against a new law that would grant women equal inheritance rights. Under the prevailing Sharia law, Bangladeshi women only inherit one quarter of that which their male counterparts do. Police arrested 125. Another 150 were hurt. At least one person died in similar protests yesterday. And more than 5,000 people have gone missing since the start of Mexico's militarized drug war. Shannon Young has more.
Mexico's National Human Rights Commission says it has documented nearly 5,400 cases of people who are, quote, missing or absent since 2006. That's when President Felipe Calderon launched a military offensive against the drug cartels. The governmental body's new data marks a sharp increase from its prior figure of less than 300. It also comes on the heels of a two-week fact-finding mission by a United Nations working group on forced disappearances. The UN Working Group made headlines on Friday for its recommendation that the Mexican government consider withdrawing the military from police work, which is a line that has been blurred by the current administration's drug war strategy. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
And thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. UBC announced today the largest gift to date to the UBC Faculty of Medicine. The $15 million donation from Vancouver philanthropist Davad Mofayan will be directed towards the new facility that integrates brain research and patient care. The facility will be named the Javad Mofayan Center for Brain Health. For Mofayan, this project became personally meaningful after he suffered a stroke last April. And while he has recovered, many are not so lucky. Neuroscience Canada estimates that 1 in 3 Canadians of all ages will be affected by disease, disorder, or injury of the brain or nervous system at some point in their lives, and as many as half of all Canadian families will have been affected by a brain disorder. Says Mofayan, quote, "The brain has been referred to as the last frontier of medicine. I hope that my gift will enable doctors and researchers to reach that frontier," end quote. The facility will be a partnership between UBC and Vancouver Coastal Health. It is scheduled to open at the UBC Hospital in 2013 and will bring together researchers and clinicians from a range of disciples related to the brain health.
In provincial news, the Vancouver Board of Trade today announced that it has established a committee in recognition of, quote, "the growing importance that Aboriginals have on the economy of British Columbia and Canada," end quote. The Aboriginal Opportunities Committee, or the AOC, has been formed to, quote, "develop, monitor, and influence policies and recommendations to promote Aboriginal economic development and self-sustainability as an important factor in Canada's economic growth," end quote. Says Calvin Helen, director of the Vancouver Board of Trade and chair of the AOC, quote, "There is a major paradigm shift taking place in Canada in relation to Aboriginal people, natural resources, and economic development. It is simply prudent to recognize that reality and begin to work together to promote cooperation and wealth creation that everyone can benefit from," end quote. The AOC's first event, the Aboriginal Opportunities Forum 2011, will be taking place on Thursday, April 7th at the Hyatt Regency Vancouver and will feature speakers such as Kim Baird, Chief of the Tsawwassen First Nation, and Sean Inchut Atlio, National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
In campus news, a UBC study published on Thursday says that populations of Fraser River sockeye salmon are so fine-tuned in their environment that any further environmental changes caused by climate change could lead to the disappearance of some populations. The study, published as the cover article in the journal Science, studied eight populations of adult Fraser River sockeye, found that populations with the most difficult migrations displayed superior swimming ability and specialized heart adaptations. They also found that the temperature where the fish performed the best matched the historical river temperatures encountered by each population on its migration routes, says Erica Eliasson, a UBC PhD candidate in zoology who co-authored the study with UBC zoology professor Tony Farrell, UBC forestry professor Scott Hinch, quote, "As climate change alters the condition of the Fraser River watershed, our concern is that some populations may not be able to adapt to these changes quickly enough to survive," end quote. Sockeye salmon have been in decline since early 1990s, and high mortality has been associated with high river temperatures that have risen nearly 2 degrees Celsius since the 1950s.
And now for News 101's election coverage. With less than a month left until Election Day, all of the political parties are rolling out their platforms. The Liberal Party, headed by Michael Ignatieff, has announced what they're calling the Canadian Learning Passport, a $1 billion education program designed to help students reach university or college. According to a press release, it would provide $4,000 of tax-free grants to every high school student who plans to pursue post-secondary education. Under the program, students from low-income families would receive $6,000 or $1,500 over 4 years through the Registered Education Savings Plan, or RESP. Every other student would receive $1,000 over 4 years. As expected, the proposal has come under attack from his opponents. NDP leader Jack Layton was critical that the plan did not address the rising cost of education. As he told reporters in Kitchener, Ontario, quote, "The key thing you have to do with education is get the costs down and hold those costs from rising. Because if tuition goes up by $1,000 at the same time, you're receiving the $1,000, you're no further ahead," end quote. Stephen Harper attacked the proposed tax restructuring, which would finance the program. Ignatieff promised to introduce the program in his first Liberal budget and finance the $1 billion a year program by repealing the Conservatives' corporate tax cuts and existing textbook and education credits.
According to a Nanos Daily tracking poll, the Conservatives have a 14-point lead over the Liberals going into their second week of campaigning. They have set themselves over the 40-point mark, a position which in the past has led to a majority government. The only region the Tories are not in the lead is in Quebec, where they are second to the Bloc. This news comes as Harper tells reporters in Ontario that a majority Conservative government would not move to restrict abortion or same-sex marriage. Harper did, however, recommit to eliminating the long gun registry. As he told a crowd in the swing district of Welland, Ontario, currently held by the NDP, quote, "Our government has long opposed the wasteful and ineffective long gun registry. We must stop targeting law-abiding gun owners and instead focus our resources on real criminals," end quote. He claimed that it was ineffective and an example of how the opposition was out of touch with everyday Canadians, especially those engaged in the hunting lifestyle. Jack Layton attacked Harper's priorities following the announcement, saying that he is ignoring the real issue in places such as Welland, where major factory closures have laid off hundreds of workers in the past few weeks. Harper has vigorously campaigned over the past 2 weeks, hoping to secure a majority government after this election.
This week, a court will weigh in on whether Green Party leader Elizabeth May should be allowed in a nationally broadcast federal leaders' debate. May wants the courts to review a 1995 CRTC ruling, which puts debate organizers under no obligation to include every candidate. Although May was included in the 2008 debates, where her party held one seat in Parliament, currently the Greens hold zero, and May has not been invited by organizers to the debates being held next week. The debates are put together by a consortium of the five major conventional networks in Canada, which has no legal standing and meets with party leaders in private to organize the broadcast. May claims that her exclusion is undemocratic, and Layton, who supports May being allowed into the debates, called the consortium a, quote, shadowy group of television executives who seemed unlikely to qualify as the best guardians of democracy, end quote. A similar issue arose in 2008 when May was initially barred from the debate, but the decision was reversed only 2 days later. The consortium has stated that it was an editorial decision on the format of the debate. When asked by the Globe and Mail whether they would reconsider, as they did in 2008, Broadcast Consortium Chairman Troy Reeb, replied that, quote, our decision is final and the decision is unanimous. It will not be reconsidered, end quote. The court will hear from Green Party lawyers tomorrow.
Finally, in our election news this week, NDP leader Jack Layton has promised to double public pension payouts. As he told a crowd during a campaign stop in Toronto, quote, we don't really have an adequate system of retirement security in the country, and that Stephen Harper's response is to ask Canadians to double down on the private plans that all too often have failed them in the past. It's simply not good enough, end quote. Since 2009, Layton has been urging the Conservatives to increase the Canadian Pension Program and Quebec Pension Program from 25% to 50% of pre-retirement income. The NDP also has a proposal to protect pensioners and workers with long-term disability. They would make it so that when a company files for bankruptcy, the first creditors to collect would be receiving those pensions and disability. This is a general reiteration of the NDP's long-held position. His campaign has been criticized as not being inventive enough, to which Layton told the Globe and Mail that Canadians would appreciate the consistency, and quote, I don't think Canadians appreciate politicians jumping around from position to an issue to issue. The second thing they like to see is some delivery on the promises. We've seen other parties promise initiatives around retirement security for years, and then they don't come through, end quote. We're going to take a quick break now, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Don't miss DJ Spooky's Terra Nova, Symphonia Antarctica, Saturday, April 9th at the Chan Center. This large-scale multimedia work is a meditation on global warming, translating DJ Spooky's first-person encounter with the harsh, dynamic landscape of Antarctica into visual and sonic portraits. This performance will also feature Corey Ham on piano, as well as string trio Infinitus. Tickets and more information can be found at chancenter.com. That's DJ Spooky, performing Terra Nova, Symphonia Antarctica, Saturday, April 9th at the Chan Center on UBC campus.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lumlin, and it's time for your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club.
Thanks, Mark. We'll expect a roller coaster week of weather as we get a break from the clouds in the middle of the week, and we'll see some temperature fluctuations. But here's your UBC forecast. For tonight, rain ending this evening, continuing with chance of showers. Tonight, the overlow will be 3 degrees. For tomorrow, 70% chance of showers throughout the day, high of 8 degrees, low of 4. For Wednesday, cloudy with 70% chance of showers again, high of 9, low of 4. For Thursday, it'll be mostly sunny, with a high of 12 and a low of 3. For Friday, cloudy with sunny periods, high of 3, low of 4. On Saturday, expect rain, a high of 11 degrees and a low of 5. And finally, for Sunday, we're going to have more rain, with a high of 11 and a low of 6 degrees. Currently, it is 4 degrees and raining at UBC. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 12 degrees and a low of 5. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
We're going to take a quick break now, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Walking alone at night can be scary!
Stop right there, student. Why walk alone when you can call SafeWalk? The safety and comfort of everyone on campus is important. That's why we're here.
SafeWalk is a free, student-run foot patrol service with two-person co-ed teams that will meet you and accompany you anywhere on campus to make sure you get there safely.
Keep an eye out for our bright red reflective jackets and signature foot logo, and let your next walk be with us.
What a huge relief! Now I'll never have to worry about the terrors that could happen when walking through such a big campus at night. Yeah.
For a walk, you can call 604-822-5355. Use one of our direct line phones located in some of the campus libraries. Use one of the big blue phone booths. Or even ask campus security to contact us.
If you see walkers around campus and you'd like them to accompany you, stop and ask.
So, welcome back to News 101. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. So, we're now joined in studio by Navi Desange, Treasurer of the UBC Residence Hall Association, to talk about life on UBC Residence and the soon-to-be-implemented first-year guarantee on housing. So, Navi, it's great to have you here with us today.
Thanks for having me, Claire.
So, tell us a bit, what is the RHA and why is it important?
So, the RHA stands for the UBC Residence Hall Association. Essentially, we are a student-run organization that receives funding from Student Housing and Hospitality Services to put on a number of events for students living in residence. We also respond to student needs, whatever those may be, and we consist of an executive council as well as constituents in every residence area.
So, about how many students is that? In total?
For students in total, we have about 8,000 living residents.
Wow, that's quite the constituency there. So why is this important? Like, why is residence important for students or residence life?
Personally for me, I find that living in residence gives me a number of academic and social opportunities that you can't really find anywhere else. I mean, waking up for 5 minutes before my 8 a.m. class and being able to stay in a library until 1 a.m. and not have to worry about catching a bus home is a pretty awesome thing to have. As well as I know I met some of my best friends through residence in my first year, and I still keep in close contact with them now. So living in residence is awesome, I have to say.
So I know we've heard a little bit about the first-year guarantee that's supposed to be implemented soon, but can you tell us a bit about that? Like, what is it?
So the first-year guarantee is a new policy that Student Housing and Hospitality Services is implementing. Essentially, any first year that is applying to the University of British Columbia will be guaranteed housing in residence. Previously, we had a restriction on students that live in the Greater Vancouver region, but that's no longer there. Just because studies have found that students that do live within residence tend to have higher academic standings as well as an overall great experience. So it's a really new and exciting initiative for Student Housing and Hospitality Services, and we hope it goes well.
Do you know what Student Housing and Hospitality, how many students I think are going to take it? Have they thrown out any numbers? Or?
To be honest, I have no idea of the statistics, so I guess we'll have to wait and find out.
Yeah, it'll be a bit of a surprise for sure. So what kind of things are they implementing to make sure that they'll have enough beds for students who will do this?
So by September, Toden Park residents will have two new buildings. I believe both of those should be able to accommodate about 500 students, as well as currently Ritz-Meiken House, which is a suite-style residence that has been meant for upper-year students, is now being converted to first-year residence as well. So those are two of the main changes that Student Housing and Hospitality Services is doing.
Wow, so what kind of impact do you think this is going to have on student life? I guess for both the new first years who wouldn't have that opportunity otherwise, as well as for students who aren't first years who would be, I guess, living on campus.
So the biggest one I would say is with RITS. Unfortunately, those upper year students that currently live there now will no longer have that opportunity to live there. It is exciting for first years, but Student Housing and Hospitality Services is well on its way to construct new buildings for upper year students. Those should be underway within the next couple of years. And yeah.
Wow, that sounds great. Do you have anything else you'd like to add about residence life for the RHA?
Nope, I'd say if you do live in residence right now, by all means, become part of the RHA. We did have elections for our new members this past week, but in September there are always new opportunities available. And if you don't live in residence, I definitely recommend, if you have the opportunity, go for it. I've had some of the best times because of my residence life experience, so it's something that people shouldn't miss out on if they're at UBC.
Great, thanks so much for coming in with us today, Navi.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that was Navi Desange, who is the treasurer of the UBC Residence Hall Association, talking about life on UBC Residence and the soon-to-be-implemented first-year guarantee on housing. So we're going to take a quick break right now, but stay with us. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm going to be around.
my vegetables, I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems. Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply. Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
It's now time for your weekly arts report with Adam Janusz. This week, Adam will be telling us about the upcoming UBC Slam performance at Corners Pub.
Individual National Poetry Slam is coming soon, and Slam UBC will be selecting their representative on April 6th at Kerner's Pub. It will feature some of the best spoken word artists from the UBC campus and Vancouver area, as well as a duo called the Two Dope Boys in a Cadillac. These guys don't just do poems on random subjects, no. Johnny McRae and Shane Avekigrek have created an entire epic mythology which describes their humble beginnings on a marijuana farm in rural BC, as well as their fleeing there from the law and winding up here in the city, which they describe as being, quote, rife with the decay of humanity, end quote. Their mission, to speak out about the coming anthropocalypse. That's right, anthropocalypse, and share their old Cadillac Mountain folk stories. So Johnny McRae came to CITR, and we explored what he's calling a talk opera. Here he is to get us started explaining the term anthropocalypse.
The anthropocalypse is a sort of a term that the folks in the Cadillac Mountains we'd learned from them, because although our families had been there for, we never really figured out how long, but it was sort of something that was part of the original reason why they ended up in the Cadillac Mountains, was that they anticipated this anthropocalypse mm-hmm. was coming, and so they were escaping the
inevitable.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. And all of this stuff will kind of feature throughout.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's almost like makes me think of like a rock opera, but kind of like a word.
Well, that's the talk opera aspect.
Talk opera, thank
you. We were trying to figure out, initially we were calling it a rock opera, and then we were just like, well, really, it's a talk opera. so we're working out what that means exactly,
yeah.
But that's the direction for sure.
Which I imagine is sort of the idea of slam poetry, is that it's kind of theatrical and dramatic mm-hmm. and takes word, spoken word, into a much more sort of bombastic realm.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find it? How did you get into it?
I have been writing for a long time, and I was doing English honors at UBC, and I was doing these seminars and writing all these short little poems that were very, you know, academic and okay. full of symbols, and no one would ever understand
Automatopoeia.
Them. Exactly.
Like alliteration.
Yeah, oh no, you don't use those. Those are too crass, you know? Like, you don't, can't use obvious poetic
wow.
things these days.
Yeah.
But I was sitting there, and I was just frustrated with everything I was writing. I was like, no one would care about this. If I put it out right now, no one would ever care. And I actually took a year off writing, and I had some friends who were doing the slam, one of them a former UBC student, Nora Smith-Eisler, had been on the team for 3 straight years as a national Canadian champion, that sort of thing, and we just met out here. And she was doing slam, and then my friend Sasha was coaching improv at the time, and she was also doing slam, and so between the two of them, that got me into it, and I actually took a year off school specifically just to start doing spoken word, and started going to slams, and then the second slam I competed in, I accidentally won. that's the only way I can put it. Yeah, like I was like, okay, yeah, I'm in it to compete, but at the same time I was like not expecting to win.
Sure.
And that got me into the playoffs, and then I got fourth in the semifinals, which got me into the finals, and I got fourth in the finals, which got me on the team.
Yeah, sure, so you're hooked.
I was hooked, and since then I've been, you know, you go to these festivals and there's like 300 poets or even just 100 poets, and you're just like, I feel like I'm home. So it became a huge part of that. And a recognition that, you know, with spoken word, with poetry generally, you're not limited in what you can say and how you can say it.
Yeah.
I cover a lot of, you know, sort of sociological, historical, gender studies related subjects. The poem that really got me started is called I Love My Vagina, and it came from watching the Vagina Monologues. And I was like, these aren't things I can really talk about in day-to-day class. Or if I do, I have to write like a 10-page paper, and I could probably say it better in 3 minutes than I can in, you know, 10 pages of argumentation and this and that, blah, blah, blah. Like, so it's just always been a more natural way of communicating for me, and something I became very passionate about, and something I'm very big on orality versus literacy and those sorts of technological shifts. And so finding this community of people that is, you know, I guess in the technical term, like a secondarily oral community, like there, it's a return to orality, but it's within a literate environment. It was just very refreshing. You know, people are very engaged, and there's something that happens to most people when they come to a spoken word event, and they realize, because most people go there, they don't know what's happening. And then you go to a slam, and you think, oh, I'm going for this crazy night of entertainment, and suddenly you've got poetry. And like, that's basically kind of what we're doing, is being like, yeah, come out and watch us do poetry. It'll be fun.
Right, right.
And people go, you know, I didn't know this could be. We do high school workshops, and the students come out of it being like, I thought poetry sucked, but I see that it's actually, you know, kind of cool. They might not tell us that directly because they're teenagers, but, you know, their teachers afterwards are like, the kids were stoked, you know, they actually liked that. They don't like most things, so that was cool.
They hate everything.
Yeah, exactly. So there's something there that's happening when you have that physical space, and that just immediately drew me right in.
I wish I had a teacher that said, the kids are stoked. Okay, that's Johnny McRae telling us about Slam UBC event coming up on Wednesday, April 6th, John McRae and Shane Avecki-Grek are the two dope boys in a Cadillac, and they will be there at Kerner's Pub on Wednesday, April the 6th, and you can catch all of that excitement for free, really, as long as you can find Kerner's Pub, which is 6371 Crescent Road.
And Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. I'm Claire Eagle. And we are now going to be talking to Mitch Anderson about the new website featured in the online magazine, the Tai'i.ca, which is titled Swing 33. So, Mitch, it's great to have you on today.
It's great to be on your program, Claire.
So, tell us a bit, what is Swing 33?
Well, Swing 33 is an opportunity for people to strategically donate to 33 swing ridings across Canada, where the vote margin in 2008 was less than 5%, and conservative candidates are running either number one or number two. This is basically an opportunity for people to contribute money to prevent Stephen Harper from becoming prime minister again.
So how much publicity has the site gained so far, and how many donations or how many people have come through, do you know?
Well, the site, the opinion piece in the Tai'i was just launched today, and there's already been a lot of interest. It seems to be trickling out through the social media quite a bit. A lot of people seem to be liking it on Facebook and tweeting about it. I don't have the latest statistics on how many people have visited the site yet, but I'm very hopeful that the word is going to get out, because I think people have heard a lot about strategic voting, but it's really hard to strategically vote if you don't live in, you know, one of the, it's really about 33 spring ridings in Canada. And in those ridings, you know, there's often not much even point in voting. Like, I live in a very solid NDP riding, and, you know, Libby Davies is going to win without my help. But for those of us that don't live in swing ridings, you can't obviously vote in those ridings, but this website gives you an opportunity to send your money there.
Right, and are these ridings, are they all around Canada, or are they concentrated in any particular place?
Well, what I did was I looked at the data provided by Elections Canada. Elections Canada is a very comprehensive website, and I just looked at the results from the 2008 election. And I looked at those ridings where the margin of victory was less than 5% and where conservatives were running number one and number two. And I just made a list out of that. So they're kind of randomly scattered all across the country. There's one in the High Arctic.
Oh, wow.
There's two on Prince Edward Island. There's one in several in Quebec. It includes members of actually every political party in Canada except the Conservatives right now. Independent.
So why is it so important? I mean, obviously we've all heard about how adept the Conservatives are at really earning, I guess, the funding that they need. But why is this so vital for other parties?
Well, there was really important changes made to election financing in 2003. In the last days of Jean Chrétien, he passed a law that basically prevented corporations or unions from making political donations, and it also set the personal limit at political donations at $1,100 a year, which isn't very much. And, you know, that really undermined the ability of both the Liberals and the NDP to raise money, because in the past they had gone to corporate donors or union donors, and into this void came Stephen Harper, and they came from kind of the Reform Party background, and they were just much better at garnering support from a large number of small donors. And, you know, I think all of those changes, most people would agree, are very positive. The problem is that most Canadians don't appreciate how important it is not just to involve yourself in the democratic process by voting, but also making contributions to those parties that, you know, are in line with your own values. And when I looked at the numbers, it was really shocking. Canadians are very generous. We give about $10 billion a year to charity.
Oh, my goodness.
That's also 300 times more than we donate to our democratic process. And right now, the Conservatives have more donors and raise more money than all other political parties put together. And what that means is they have an enormous advantage at getting their message out, whether it's a message that people agree with or not. And for instance, the Conservatives have three times as many donors as the Liberals and four times as many as the NDP. But, you know, that level of support certainly is not reflected in poll data or his success at the ballot box.
Right.
So what I'm really trying to do here is level the fundraising playing field, so to basically further democracy in Canada.
So are there any specific ridings that people are really interested in? I know I've heard that Elizabeth May is running in a tough competition, but...
Yeah, and, you know, the site has actually changed since we put up, because I really wanted to make sure that this was seen as a nonpartisan effort. I'm not aligned with any political party, and I'm certainly not trying to pick winners. We're just trying to pick one loser, if you can put it that way. And some of the feedback we got very early on from the article in the Tie is people pointing out that Elizabeth May is in a very tight race right now on Sandwich Gulf Islands, and all the poll data shows that it's really a two-way race between Gary Lund of the Conservatives and Elizabeth May of the Green Party. And, you know, we've made that change on the website to reflect that, you know, this math that we did in 2008 doesn't reflect the reality on the ground right now. And there's probably been a couple of other tweaks we're going to make as well, just to make sure that, you know, people aren't you know, contributing money in a way that's going to split the vote against the Conservatives, or, you know, there's a couple of independents that were running in 2008 that aren't now. But for the most part, people, when they go to the website, have an ability to click and link to the donation page of the leading opposition candidate in those 33 ridings. And I think that's important for some people because, you know, some people, you know, myself included, have a certain hesitancy to donate to the head office of political parties. And this really allows you to target your donation to those candidates in these really 33 tight races in this election.
So what if people do want to donate to the Conservatives? I suppose they just won't use your website, but do you think people would find offense at that? Or I guess what do you see the response being from those who do want to pledge their support for Conservatives?
Well, you know, I certainly I don't begrudge the Conservatives. I actually think that they deserve a lot of credit for the amount of effort and expertise they've put into their fundraising efforts. And I think the rest of the political parties in Canada, and frankly, the rest of the Canadian public, kind of has to catch up to that. When I looked at the numbers, it was pretty shocking that, you know, the number of Canadians that donate to political parties is around 0.5%. And the really interesting thing is that if you look at Canadian tax law, you get a far more generous tax break by donating to political parties than you do to charities. For instance, if you donate $400, then you get $300 of those back in tax credits. And again, it's not like you can empty your bank account and give it to the party of your choice, because everyone's personal donation is capped at $1,100. So I really think, you know, what this is trying to do is more than anything else, promote awareness and discussion of the importance of people participating not just as voters but as donors to a political party. And if anything, you know, my hat is going off to the Conservatives. I think they've done a terrific job of grassroots fundraising, and the rest of the parties and the general public that doesn't necessarily agree with Stephen Harper has to catch up with that and appreciate that, you know, elections are not won on good intentions. It requires resources to do so, and it's far better if those resources come from the grassroots, ordinary Canadians getting involved in their political process.
Well, great. Thanks so much, Mitch. It's great to have you on today, and best of luck with the website, and we hope it really does continue to engage Canadians.
Oh, please do, and go to swing33.ca and get involved.
Definitely. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Mitch Anderson discussing the new website, swing33.ca, which is designed to show which are the key swing ridings in the upcoming Canadian election and help people strategically donate to these parties, especially if they're not able to strategically vote. So we are now going to just go to international news briefly and play a clip from Free Speech Radio News regarding the Ivory Coast and how the UN is engaging in military action there.
In Ivory Coast, fighting has intensified between numerous forces, and aid groups warn of massacres and a desperate humanitarian crisis. Hundreds of people are dead, and there are reports of atrocities by both sides against civilians. According to the Catholic aid group Caritas, up to 1,000 civilians were killed or disappeared in one Ivorian town in late March, although the group said they did not know who was responsible. Many thousands of residents in Abidjan lack electricity, food and water, and civilians who managed to flee the country are stuck in overcrowded refugee camps. Today, UN helicopters started firing missiles at a weapons stockpile used by forces loyal to incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo, and French troops have taken control of the airport in Abidjan. On Ivory Coast State Television, a Gbagbo spokesperson, Damana Picas from the Young Patriots, called on the population to support Gbagbo.
You who are held in your houses for fear that they will come and kill you, starting right now, everyone must go outside, not only to defend your neighbourhood, go outside to hunt down the rebels, and especially go outside to converge on the residence of Mr. Laurent Gbagbo and make a human shield around it.
Sound and translation courtesy of the BBC. In Syria yesterday, thousands of people attended the funeral of eight people killed during protests in the capital Damascus on Friday. During weeks of demonstrations against the administration of President Bashar al-Assad, dozens have been killed and many hundreds arrested. The protests started nearly 3 weeks ago in Daraa after a group of students were arrested for writing anti-government graffiti. When their village leaders went to seek their release, they were insulted and beaten, according to local news reports. The incident sparked protests in Daraa and across the country. In his latest response to the crisis, after sacking the government last week, President Assad appointed a former agriculture minister to form a new cabinet. For more, we go to Wissam Tarif, a human rights researcher who is in Damascus. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you. Thank you for calling, and thank you for the interest in Syria.
What can you tell us about the weekend's protest which took place at the funeral for those killed during demonstrations last week?
Well, on Friday, people who protested in Douma, people tried to protest in different parts of Damascus, and one of those was Douma. Now, Douma people actually managed to protest because at the beginning they had a security presence was in different parts of Damascus, and there wasn't a huge amount of security in Douma, which led also for protesters and people to come from other parts of Damascus and join the people who were demonstrating in Douma. The security opened the fire or lit ammunition on the protesters. At the beginning, we were saying that four people were killed. By today, the number confirmed that 15 people have been killed in Douma on Friday. Eight were buried yesterday. And the other bodies are still in the Tashrin Military Hospital. They are not from Douma. They are from different areas of Damascus. And people now are trying to access the Tashrin Hospital to identify bodies. You have to take into consideration that there is a big number of people who are reported missed in the country, and we don't have a clue. We don't know where are they, because there is a big number of arbitrary detention, and at the same time there are bodies that are identified in the morgues of hospitals. Human rights organization, media do not have access to as well.
Can you describe for us the situation on the streets where you are? What is the security presence like?
Well, the secret was the police in Syria is not secret anymore, and you can spot security forces almost in every corner in Damascus or anywhere else I have been to the last few days. There is a heavy security presence, there is a campaign of intimidation, there is an attempt to build again this wall of fear, this high wall of fear that has been built for the last 4 years by the Ba'ath regime in Syria. And people in Syria have broken that wall, and people were able to express their views and to demonstrate something, a seed, which just like 15 days ago, no one would believe it's doable or it would happen in Syria. It has happened. It is happening as we speak. In return, security presence, the regime, is responding with an intimidation campaign. Security are walking with their clashing calls. They are walking with sticks in the hands. There are thugs which are supported by security police in Latakia and in other cities as well in Syria. And I think President al-Assad, when he was supposed to address the nation last Wednesday, I think he did not address the nation. I think he addressed the machinery of oppression in the country. When the president calls people, his people, who are protesting and asking for their rights, for freedom of expression, calls them people who are conspiring against Syria, then of course this is a green light for the machinery of oppression, for the security police to act violently against those protesters.
Wissam Tarif, human rights researcher in Damascus, Syria. Stay safe in Damascus, and thank you very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you. Thank you for calling.
And that's our program for April 4th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. Or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Claire Eagle.
Today's show was produced by Claire Eagle. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We wrote this for a
purpose to motivate you at this time. With this hypnotizing baseline, please feel free to lose your mind. And get high, get money, get dressed, get real, all in between. Oh yeah, this is stadium music, 50,000 at a time. Let's get right, let's get right, let's get right, okay. Let's get right, let's get right, let's get right, okay. All the girls want, all they looking for is, all they ask for is, they keep wanting that. Look at you, look at me, look at you, look at me. She's dancing for a reason, not just cause I'm on a hind. Homeboy is totally obvious, you don't be listening to her mind. She wanna get right, get money, get dressed, get real, all intertwined. This is stadium music, 50 thou, jumping at a time.
Let's get right, let's get right, let's get right.